I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. There were more protests in Philadelphia yesterday against police brutality as there were in other cities. In Minneapolis yesterday, the charges against fired police officer Derek Chauvin, accused of killing George Floyd, were upgraded to second-degree murder, and the three fired officers with him were charged with abetting murder. Back in Philadelphia, the police department has reported more than 700 arrests since Saturday and some 25 officers who have been injured. The police have been criticized for using force and tear gas to disperse peaceful protesters, for arresting journalists covering the demonstrations, and for not intervening in Fishtown on Monday night when there were reports of men with bats threatening and attacking people. We're going to talk more about police behavior and reforms a bit later in the show. We begin our conversation with Larry Krasner. He is the District Attorney of Philadelphia. Larry Krasner, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You told protesters earlier this week that protesting is not a crime. We are not going to charge you for protesting. And yet we've got some 700 arrests. Not all of them, of course, are protesters, but protesters have been arrested. Journalists have been arrested. What's going on?
Well, a lot of things are going on. I think there's some good news and there's some bad news. The good news, if we look back at the debacle that happened in the year 2000 with massive arrests of people for what was, in fact, protest activity, is that we are seeing that that there's not a whole lot of use of misdemeanor and felony charging related to anything that looks like protest activity. There's a lot of summary offenses that are being charged. That charging is done entirely by the police. The DA's mm-hmm. office plays no role in that. But that's an improvement. It's an improvement to go to a curfew violation that's essentially the equivalent of a ticket, and we'll figure out down the road what to do with it, as opposed to stuffing jails with people, putting them through bail hearings, having them in custody for many hours, and then held on false high bails, as happened in the RNC. So I think there's some good news that this city in 20 years learned to stop being, pretty much the most draconian in the United States when it came to normal protest activity. It is also the case that we have a different phenomenon here. We have protest, most of it peaceful, and then we have actual opportunistic crimes that are going on. As I look at the cases my office has charged, which is a lower number than that total number you gave, because so many of these cases are being charged as summaries. As I look at that, what I see is almost three-fourths of the cases we're charging are burglaries and criminal trespasses. In other words, these are people often caught inside of a business establishment where they have no business being. They've gone through a broken window or they've gone through a broken door and they're coming out with merchandise. That is, Martin Luther King did not do that, okay? He did not come out of stores with other people's stuff. That is an opportunistic crime. It is not being done by people who have gathered for peaceful protest. And I think it's probably, it's terrible news that we have this going on in many places around the city. We have our pharmacies devastated in certain portions of the city. So many business owners are trying to react to the weight of this. That's terrible. But it is true that among the approximately, 400-plus cases that we've charged so far, over 300 of them are burglaries and criminal trespasses. So the number of arrests that seem to have anything to do with protest activity, and anything to do with doesn't mean they're actually protesting, it just has something to do with it, is really closer to something like 100.
Well, let's talk about what happened on 676, and there were protesters there. Traffic clearly was stopped. There are reports of being pepper sprayed and the police really moving in on what were described as peaceful protesters. Did the police go too far?
I can tell you that we have a number of active investigations, that we're looking very carefully at a lot of things. I'm not in a position to confirm whether or not we are looking into that, but we take our obligation to hold everyone accountable very seriously, and that means police as well. It means police in terms of whether they are telling the truth when they bring allegations against people and want them charged with crimes, but it also means in terms of their conduct. Are they cracking someone's skull with no basis? Are they using militaristic tactics against entirely peaceful people? We intend to hold everyone responsible, and I'm not in a position to jackpot any ongoing investigations.
Well, and obviously people have the right to protest, but there obviously are limits. When someone's right to protest intervenes with someone's right to get to work, as a lawyer yourself, how do we sort of navigate through those very different rights and responsibilities?
I think we start with a level of just common sense and life experience. Sure, nobody wants to be slowed down on the road, but trucks flip over, and then you get slowed down sometimes for hours, and we don't immediately take that truck driver and say, that's a crime. Mm. We're going to stick you in jail. You're in Center City. You're driving down Market Street. There's a giant crane blocking the road on a Saturday for 3 hours to put a heating cooling unit on the top of a building. We don't automatically say, oh, my God, that's a crime. That's a terrible thing. We consider those things, which are not an aspect of any constitutional right, to be normal. When we have a celebration because the Eagles or the Phillies or the Sixers have had some kind of big national victory, and we frankly shut down traffic for 6-8 hours, and a few people get out of hand, flip cars, light them on fire, which has happened, light bonfires in the middle of the street. When we do that, no one says, oh, my God, let's arrest everybody. Let's arrest all the police who blocked the roads. Let's arrest the mayor. Everybody says that, you know, some blockage of the flow of traffic is a normal part of life and it has a basis. And now let's layer on that the fact that none of that is a constitutional right. There's not a constitutional right to celebrate a sports event, but there is a constitutional right to assemble. There is a constitutional right to express yourself, constitutional right to free speech. Those rights are all about the separation from the government's power and individual's power. So we're talking about a sacred right. It is by no means unusual, nothing abnormal about police tolerating for a limited period of time the blockage of a road by people sitting in it, by people walking on a highway. There's nothing unusual about that. So we need to be willing to be even-handed when we look at these things and understand that when people on an issue of this magnitude are simply exercising a sacred right, that doesn't mean you got to tear gas them, you got to arrest them right away. Now, I am not passing judgment on what happened or why it happened, because I don't do that until I have all the facts. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that in general terms, that's just what the law is.
Do police have a right to arrest journalists?
I'm sorry?
Do police have a right to arrest journalists?
Only if they're committing crimes. And honestly, in a free society, they should give journalists more space, more room. I mean, I've watched coverage in the last several days. It's concerning to me, and I want you to know I've communicated it to the commissioner, because I believe the commissioner doesn't want journalists mistreated and pushed around like they have no right to be there. But it's very concerning to me to see journalists on the street when looting is going on and they're being, physically mistreated. They're being verbally mistreated. They're being shoved out of areas where they're obviously going to do no harm. They're there with a camera crew and where people have a right to know what's going on. So, no, they shouldn't be mistreated. They shouldn't be arrested. They shouldn't have their heads bashed into anything. That's not how this should be in a democracy. And I am not saying that, I'm not saying specifically that has occurred in any location in Philly. I am saying it's concerning what I have seen. And, you know, we have a hotline. We receive information on that hotline all the time. The number for that hotline actually is 215-686-9608. And we're receiving a lot of community complaints about things like the Fishtown, you know, vigilantes. We've got a lot of direct message and Twitter videos that have been sent to us, which have actually been quite helpful in finding out the facts that are underlying certain cases. We want that. We need everyone's rights respected. We need to respect the safety and rights of the police, and we need to respect the safety and rights of everyone else equally.
A lot of us have watched some of the video from the Fishtown incidents on Monday night, and there were men, largely white men, with bats. I saw one with an axe, terrorizing people, threatening people, acting like tough guys. Is that legal? Can you stand on the streets of Philadelphia with a bat and have altercations, or threatening altercations with other people?
No, you can stand on a street in Philadelphia with a bat because you're going to a softball game or you are coaching kids in Little League, but we have an offense in Pennsylvania known as possession of an instrument of crime that basically says whatever the item is, if you're using it for an unlawful purpose, then that's a crime. So if I take my shoe and I throw it at somebody else's head because I'm mad and I want to hurt them, that shoe just became an instrument of crime. If you stand on a corner, and I'm going to go to the Wayback Machine, and you act like Lester Maddox and Lester Maddox's buddies walking around with axe handles in order to threaten black people, in order to threaten protesters, if you do that, which is essentially what these men did, you're not doing it to play midnight softball. You're doing it to threaten people. That, you know, we had reports of two assaults that night. I'm sure you're aware that one of the victims was someone affiliated with WHYY.
Yeah, he's one of my producers. I'll just put it out there. Go ahead.
Right, right. And, there are indications that he got beaten up for simply videoing what these men were doing. We have reports about a threat to follow someone home and burn down that person's house. You know, this is not acceptable. Lester Maddox's behavior, walking around with axe handles, was not acceptable. This is not acceptable. And anyone, especially in light of that context, walking around with a baseball bat, walking around with a hatchet, walking around with weapons, using racial epithets, be advised that is arguably possession of an instrument of crime, terroristic threats. You hit anybody, you're talking about aggravated assault, simple assault, conspiracy. These are crimes. If you do them, you're going to be held accountable for them.
Just a couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye to you. And we're going to be talking more with our two guests about this moment that we're in and whether police reform is possible. You mentioned the fact that in 2000, 20 years ago, the police really overcharged a lot of protesters, lesser charges today. Do you see reform on the horizon in Philadelphia?
I do see reform on the horizon. Very exciting that Frank Rizzo, the statue, and the man are no longer in place. Very exciting that there's not a shadow coming off of that statue, because Frank's long shadow has been influencing this city from when I was about 9 years old, from the, you know, when I was first in this area. The amount of power that he has managed to exert, and that particularly racist policy of unaccountable police violence on politics, on the police department itself, on Philadelphia itself, for these 50-some years, is almost inestimable. And I think it's a very strong indication that change is coming when you see government that somehow held him up as the only mayor who mattered enough to be near City Hall, even if it was just in bronze. When you see government take that away, then finally, they have gotten a message that people believe in equality in the city, that they expect everyone to be accountable, and that includes police.
And we should say that this happened overnight, very quietly. The statue was defaced by protesters, and it's gone.
It was defaced, and it's been defaced many, many times over the years, and just as the giant mural of Frank Rizzo was the most defaced mural out of 4,000 in Philadelphia for quite some time, because that's what he represents to so many people. He represents a fundamental attack. That was truly our Confederate general statue, and it's good it's gone.
Larry Krasner, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're welcome. He's the District Attorney of Philadelphia, and there is a special investigations hotline unit to report possible police misconduct and brutality. And again, that phone number, 215-686-9608. And yes, we'll be talking more about police misconduct, police reform. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. There are new charges against fired Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, now accused of second-degree murder in the death of George Floyd. He pressed his knee on Floyd's neck for almost 9 minutes, ignoring his cries that he couldn't breathe. The three other officers with him who were also fired now face charges of abetting murder. This horrifying incident caught on tape has led to nationwide protests calling for the end of police brutality and system-wide reforms to address policies and practices that target African Americans. That is our topic for today's Radio Times. And joining us is Donald Tibbs. He's a professor of law at St. Thomas University in Miami. I should add, he was a guest on Radio Times a bunch of times when he taught at Drexel University. Donald Tibbs, nice to have you back with us on the show.
Thank you for the invitation, Marty. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us is Tracy Kazee, and she served for 25 years in the Denver Police Department. She worked with the NYPD in various capacities, including Deputy Commissioner of Training. She's co-founder and Senior Vice President for Justice Initiatives at the Center for Policing Equity. And Tracy Kazee, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to our listeners, and we do want to hear from you. There is so much to talk about. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Tracy Kazee, let me begin with you, and actually just going back to the death, frankly, of George Floyd, and many of us have watched that several times to see what those moments, those minutes were like. Is a chokehold like that with a knee on the neck, is that ever permissible in police work?
You know, it's not the question, was it ever permissible? You're looking at someone who believed he needed to restrain someone in that way for whatever reason he gave himself. But, you know, the use of, you know, the karate technique, or, you know, some folks call it a chokehold, at points in time in policing were permissible under certain policies. And a lot of departments have done away with those things. And so, again, as, you know, policing begins to evolve and tries to evolve and tries to move forward, it is maneuvers like that, policies that support that, are all of what's in question right now.
I mean, would you say it's time to ban those kinds of holds?
Oh, yeah, it's time. And a lot of departments have done that.
Also, looking at the tape, and I do want to get you in on the conversation, Donald Tibbs, but back to you, Tracy.
Sure.
Kazee, though, looking at the tape and, you know, the kind of nonchalance that we see. I mean, obviously, this is going on. There are bystanders who are talking to the police saying, you know, this man is saying he can't breathe. The kind of nonchalance that we see from Derek Chauvin and, frankly, the other three officers is really kind of breathtaking.
Yeah, I mean, it's more than breathtaking, especially as, you know, officers who have a duty to protect.
Right.
It's extremely breathtaking, but it also speaks to the work that has to be done about the attitudes and behaviors around who deserves to be safe, what does safety look like, who's a criminal, what is criminal behavior, and what types of responses are given to specific people. So it's not just the nonchalantness of it. It's so much more than that. And so I think that part of the struggle here, because one of the things that, you know, folks keep asking me about is, how is this different? For, you know, millions of Black folks, this is not different. This is more of the same. And so the question becomes one of, are we going to have the same response we've been having over the last decade or so?
Which is clearly something we should talk about. Donald Tibbs, let me get you into the conversation. I do want to talk about the changed charges against Derek Chauvin, but I also want to just get your response. As you look at that videotape, what do you see?
So, Marty, let me say that I have a odd sense of deja vu with this conversation. And I know that, as you mentioned, we've had this conversation on numerous occasions regarding all of the other incidents where African-American men have lost their life needlessly at the hands of the institution of policing. And it's just such an over-the-top tragedy that George Floyd was essentially murdered in the street, and by all legal means, social means, was murdered in the street by the very people who are supposed to be protecting him. I'm so overwhelmingly sad for him that his life was taken this way. I'm overwhelmingly sad for his siblings, for his parents, for his children who have to live with a scarred memory associated with this. And I'm also sad at the sense of helplessness and hopelessness that continues to resonate in the African-American community as it pertains to the police and the police force that they should be working hand in hand with. And so I just wanted to say that I've had a sense of, or mix of emotions that have gone from almost, well, here we go again, to these things continue to happen, to outrage, to this just shouldn't occur, to then finally, when is it going to stop? So I'm sort of glad that we're at this moment where it seems at least far more people are paying attention to the incidences and the ways in which African-American life is devalued in this country, the ways in which African-American men are treated, policed by citizens as well as policed by the police themselves, sort of thinking about the Ahmaud Arbery case and the Christian Cooper case, which both occurred prior to this, which involved citizens policing right. black bodies. And now we're talking about the police right. policing black bodies. It's almost as if we just can't escape it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tracy, it sounds like you want to add something to what Donald Tibbs just said there. Go ahead.
I certainly don't need to add, but to amplify. I mean, you know, spot on. And I think that, you know, as we try to move forward, and I know we'll probably get into this conversation as well.
Sure.
The word of reforming police. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a completely different conversation now. And as I've said, you know, to many folks this week, if you think policing is going to be the same on the other side of this, we are absolutely mistaken. And for folks that think that we're going to be able to, you know, go back to the ways of which we thought was what I would always consider to be community engagement in a way that is not meaningful, not authentic and legitimate, then we are in for more of the same.
Yeah, I mean, this is clearly a potential turning point. Donald Tibbs, let me go back to you.
If I could say something about that, Marty.
Sure.
I completely agree that policing is going to be different, but I think it's very important to say that the only change that's going to happen to policing is going to have to come from within the institution itself. Mm. It's been very obvious that, you know, protests and citizen review boards and things of that nature are not making the kind of strides that they need to make. And what we need is we need police to start policing themselves. We need them to apply the same rigor to their colleagues in terms of holding their colleagues accountable as it pertains to when they are performing their duties in such a way that is a devaluation of life, that is unconstitutional, that is illegal, that is socially immoral, that is racially immoral. We want the institution to flip on the inside, take a serious evaluation of itself, and police itself with the same rigor. You know, when you go around the city and you look at signs that say, if you see something, say something. Those are plastered all over the city to ask for citizens and the community and people of this great nation to speak up about acts of violence or acts of terrorism that may be occurring in their presence where the police aren't there. I would simply say back to the police, when you see something, say something, right? Mm-hmm. Don't allow your brothers mm-hmm. and your sisters of the organization to tear you apart from the inside. There's always this conversation about bad apples on the police force. And you know what we do with bad apples? We get them out of the bunch. That's the only way that the rest of the apples actually will taste good and survive. And so continuing to have these bad apples and continuing to sort of act in silence while these acts of violence are occurring in the presence of other police officers is really to sort of fortify the existence of this type of behavior to make these bad officers make good officers look actually bad. And causes real problems with the institution itself. So we want to have a different type of rigor and look from the inside. Mm.
Well, Tracy Kazee, you have done training for the NYPD, for the New York Police Department. You served for 25 years with the Denver Police Department. Do we need a different kind of police officer? Obviously, there are good officers, it needs to be said, who are doing extraordinary work. But nonetheless, do we need to rethink the kind of training for officers and what they need to be skilled at?
So it's not just rethink the training, right? We need to rethink what we want our police officers to really be doing every day. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. we can train, and we train, and most officers in most academies, you know, the recruits are in for 6 months. They get a lot. But it's more than just the training. And I want to go back to, you know, what was just said a minute ago.
Sure.
It is about who you're selecting to come into that organization. But if you don't deal with the organizational culture, I don't care who you bring in with the best of intentions to serve. If you don't deal with the culture, if you don't deal with what's been happening historically within organizations. Because if you think about it, one of the probably biggest, I would say, issue that's lifted up about changing police departments internally is diversifying them. If you have not talked to Black officers and to the struggle that they are going through right now, and women and folks at the intersection of those pieces, then you are, again, are missing the point. It is not just the training. It is not just, do we need a new kind of officer? It is the culture of policing. It's the narratives that support them. It is all of the different things that for history has really never been challenged. You know, when you hear the words law and order, when you hear the words, you know, policing, these are fundamental terms that are going to be changed anyway. But if we don't begin to put new language in, make sure we're clear about how we want to be protected, or even public safety. And in some cases, you hear communities saying they don't want police at all. We've gotten there. Mm-hmm. So it's really more than just that. It is, you know, it's multiple things, all of them intertwined. And you really have to begin to go back to how policing was introduced in the United States. And it was, and you've heard this probably, you know, lots of times, this was about slave patrols. This was about putting people in their places and keeping them in their places. And then when you talk about how policing intersects with so many things, with housing, with redlining, with keeping people where they're supposed to be, with education, with having officers in schools, you know, with mental health now, as we look at folks responding to people in crisis. And you will have chiefs that will tell you, we're in social spaces we really should not be. That's another conversation that's not being had.
Absolutely. And we'll try to fit that one in as well. I'm sorry to jump in there. We got so many people that want to join us. And let me just read an email from Thomas. And Donald Tibbs, I'll give you a chance to respond. Thomas says, if we want to reduce police violence against people of color, part of the solution is going back to the fundamentals and significantly limiting when and how it is permissible to use force to enforce the law. And there is it's a kind of a perhaps dense legal regulation or called qualified immunity, and in that police are allowed to use force in the way that us civilians cannot. But are they overprotected in their ability to do that?
Well, I mean, it certainly is a requirement under the law for the police to be able to use force. It's necessary in their job to be able to take someone and move them from one position to another. That constitutes force under the law, even though, albeit it may be a small amount of force. It's not the concern of the use of force, but it's a greater issue is one of an excessive use of force. And the law doesn't allow an excessive use of force in any context, whether it be for citizens or whether it be for the police officers. The difference is one of how we evaluate what constitutes excessive, right? Mm-hmm. For average citizens, because we don't have a right to use force, but in very limited circumstances, i.e. defense of self, defense of others, maybe defense of property, the only way that we get to use force in those scenarios is if it doesn't breach some context of reasonableness under the law. But police officers get a greater use of force, and they get greater access to force just because of the nature of their job. But they also can't act excessively. So it isn't just as simple, the statutes. There was a Supreme Court case that was decided in 1989 called Graham versus Connor. And I can only imagine that this case is probably taught at every police department around the nation. I actually pulled the police policies from Minnesota and found that the case is actually listed in their policies and discussed. And what the court said in Graham versus Connor is that essentially they will evaluate an excessive use of force based upon a reasonable objective standard as it pertains to whether other police officers or a police officer acted reasonably. The problem with that standard is that you're asking to measure police officers acting reasonably with an institution that's acting unreasonable in and of itself. So it becomes basically a pass for police officers because they are evaluated against what other police officers would have done given this same scenario. And so when you have that kind of standard used as a measurement,
it eventually leads to a lack of accountability, because that means that it will require other police officers to say, I would have done something entirely different given this exact same set of facts.
I hear you.
And
yeah.
That's where the culture and the institution becomes problematic, because oftentimes police officers don't want to snitch on other police officers, even though technically they're required under the law to do so. And this is why we even saw the other officers in the George Floyd case stand around and do nothing while this man is basically gasping for life. There's something about an intervention with one police officer to another that is causing this problem. And so it's really an excessive force question.
Tracy, because a related email, this one from Greg, asks, how much of a problem are police unions? How do you see the role that they're playing?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to depend on where you are, right? So we know unions have a real big role to play here, but it's going to really depend on whether or not that union is the collective bargaining unit or whether or not it's what we would call a police association. So representing some group that is considerably the other. Unions play a big role. So we watch this play out, not just in New York, but, you know, in Minnesota as well, in Minneapolis. So what you have here is, like most unions, entities that are created to protect workers' rights. The problem that we are seeing with unions is, if you want to do reform or if you want to discipline officers, you will find yourself not just with hurdles from those rights that are listed maybe in their collective bargaining pieces, but as well as whatever processes those cities or counties have in place, this multi-layer effect that really makes it difficult to get at what you need to. And the unions, of course, are paid, and we paid into them, I paid into them, to protect the rights of that worker. That includes providing attorneys. That includes, you know, making public statements, even though they may be absolutely, you know, absurd, all of those things. The bigger question around unions is, if you know that you have a union body that is really sort of acting as a deflector for conversations for reform, the other question is, and again, this is what we've been talking about internally.
You know what, Tracy, if you don't mind just holding that, because we're about 10 seconds away from our break, hold on to that thought. We'll pick up that thought after this very short break, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with our guests and with you about police reform, about civil rights, about protests. Our guests are Donald Tibbs, professor at St. Thomas University School of Law in Miami. Tracy Kesey served for 25 years in the Denver Police Department. She was deputy commissioner of training for the New York Police Department, and she is co-founder and senior vice president for justice initiatives at the Center for Policing Equity. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. It looks like a lot of people want to join our conversation. Tracy, I had to jump on you right before the break there, and you were talking just about unions. Yeah, if you could just finish your thought, go ahead.
Sure. No, so what I was saying is that you have to understand that if the main thing you need to look at, so if unions are created to protect workers' rights, there has to be a point where not just the employees they're protecting have to begin to question whether or not that representation is still appropriate. And so one of the things that we still continually ask questions about as we look throughout, you know, the United States with unions, you know, they're elected. Union, mm-hmm. Union heads are elected. They're elected by usually a small group of people within the organization, but yet they are still elected. So we go back to the conversation about the internal changes that have to happen in order for true reform to happen.
Donald Tibbs, I want to give you a chance to respond to something that James Mattis wrote in The Atlantic yesterday. Of course, former defense secretary, he was responding to what happened in Lafayette Park earlier this week when the military essentially was called in to remove peaceful protesters so that the president could stand in front of a church there with a Bible. Mattis wrote, "When I joined the military some 50 years ago, I swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Never did I dream that troops taking that same oath would be ordered under any circumstance to violate the constitutional rights of their fellow citizens, much less to provide a bizarre photo op for the elected commander-in-chief with military leadership standing alongside." Picking up on that very specific moment, but we do see the kind of militarization of a lot of police departments with tanks and with police officers that look like they could be in Afghanistan or in Iraq fighting a war. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so I think it's a very telling moment about where we are in terms of our times. That the last time we had this conversation, Marty, we were talking about the use of the police in the Michael Brown protest and the images of the police dressing in camouflage in the city streets and using assault style weapons. And I think they're called MRAP vehicles, which are basically tanks that are designed to resist explosive devices that are put into the ground, and the sort of rolling out of that image of the militarization of the police. And that was the topic then of this is what the police force is starting to look like. But now what we're seeing in response is we're not talking about the militarization of the police as much as now just the military. Mm-hmm. The military is actually being used to basically thwart constitutional rights. People have the right to peacefully protest. People have the right to file petitions of redress against the government. And so the use of a military force, one of the greatest forces in the entire world, against citizens who are peacefully standing by just simply so that the president can have a extremely weird and awkward photo op that hasn't been supported by anyone, is really telling of where we are as a government. One of the things that I think we have to take notice is that when President Obama was in office, he created a commission basically for studying 21st century policing. And I believe at the time, Police Chief Ramsey, who was the chief at Philadelphia, was invited to be on that commission. And one of the things that they wanted to look into as a part of that commission was this very issue of the militarization of the police, this very issue of how weapons are passed on from the military and given to the police officer, this very issue of how police officers are actually ex-military members, special forces, things of that nature. And so that commission was designed to study this, to make a difference. But with all of the rollbacks and looking at the programs that have been put in place, it's very telling that when the president talks about being a law and order president, he's not thinking about law and order in the same way. It is law. And it is order to be able to peacefully protest. What could be more legal and orderly than a peaceful protest that's allowed under the U.S. Constitution? So the use of the military, the rolling out of vehicles, the attacks on the press, the use of rubber bullets and tear gas and things of that nature, in a sense where they're not really necessary. What you see in those moments are the police actually creating the violence, right? And then turning around and saying, because of the violence, we need to react. So they get to actually create the problem and then create a justification of the problem by reacting to it. So it's really problematic. And I'm really glad that more people are stepping out and denouncing that move by the president. And I think more senators and more elected officials need to do the same.
Tracy Kazee, let me get a caller who's been waiting very patiently to join our conversation. And this is Charles, who's a sociology professor at LaSalle University, which is in Philadelphia. And Charles, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thank you. I completely agree with your callers that there's a need to change police culture. But that culture is embedded in and controlled by whites and basically what are white institutions. And what I'm working on now is I've been working on white racial attitudes for the last two decades. And most of white America, appalled by what they saw with this state-sanctioned murder, But they believe, for the most part, the criminal justice system works. I mean, I'm looking at polling data. Almost half of whites believe that the criminal justice system treats blacks and whites equally. That's CNN. People believe what happened. A majority of 60% of whites believe that the killing in Ferguson in New York were isolated incidents. 68% believe that race was not a motivating factor or a minor factor in the killing of Michael Brown. And more telling to me is that a majority now, 50% of whites believe that discrimination against whites is as big a problem as discrimination against racial minorities. And so, you know, that the white mentality, and again, I'm not generalizing to 200 sure. million whites, but a sizable part of the white population, they believe now that, you know, equal opportunity is the norm. The socioeconomic playing field is level. We have Barack Obama. Whites and blacks have equal opportunity in those spheres of social and economic life. Whites are now targeted. And the idea is that if anything that happens is the fault of black and brown people for overstepping the bounds. I'm already hearing these little whispers. This man got what was coming because he was trying to float a fake $20 bill. So I
hear
completely
you.
Agree with what you mm-hmm. So, like, how do we deal with a larger systemic issue that many, many whites believe there isn't a problem? The problem is with these communities.
Fair enough. Charles, I appreciate the call. And I know, Tracy, you want to respond. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so, and first of all, thank you for, you know, bringing up the polling data and the such stark differences in the experiences of whites and non-whites and black folks in particular with the police. So the polling data doesn't surprise me because that is a snapshot of your own worldview and your own lived experience, right? So we know this to be true. The bigger question for me is why folks would think that a person deserves to die the way that they did. And so that speaks to me more than, you know, we believe the police are doing well and that, you know, now it's about whites not having equal rights. It is really telling that fundamentally we still are not having the same conversations or the same understanding of what's really going on here. And if you don't allow yourself to see what is happening to someone else or even open yourself up to understand that their experience may not and cannot, in some cases will not, be the same of yours, then that's a bigger issue. And it is one that will continue to haunt us until we actually step up and say, might not have had the same experience, but what I saw was wrong. And I'm still baffled, I think, by the conversations I know I'm having, where I'm hearing people making donations to black causes, and when I'm hearing them talk, still not getting it. And so that's the frustration of, you know, of black folks. If you, you know, the example I will use, I'm not a football fan, but if you look at the tweets that Drew Brees did yesterday in regards to Colin Kaepernick, you know, let's talk about taking a knee. My Chiefs are great, but the question is, you understand why he was taking a knee? Because it got co-opted, much like a lot of things do. It got co-opted into non-patriotism. It's about the military. When it was simply about what we see playing out in the streets today. And yet we have Chiefs taking a knee, locking arms, which is great. It's for them. And I think for the community to see that, but we question, do you really understand why this is happening now? And that is, you know, a conversation that should not be led by folks of color. Frankly, there is generational collective exhaustion here. And so this is going to be a struggle.
Sure.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Donald Tibbs, go ahead. I know you want to jump in. Go ahead.
Yeah, just real quickly, and I really appreciate the polling data and the call also, and I think it's very telling of, once again, where we are ideologically in this country. I mean, what we're really talking about here is the dismantling of a white supremacist ideology that basically provides white Americans with the privilege to speak about things that they haven't experienced. So in other words, the problem that becomes associated with the polling data and the way that people have certain opinions about what has happened is simply because it primarily is not happening to them, right? And so that privilege to not only not have it happen to you, but then to be able to have an opinion about those who it happens to and to sort of disconnect from the humane parts, the inhumane parts of having someone suffocated to death for what
may have been or may not have been a counterfeit $20 bill. We don't even know technically that it was his. We will never be able to find out those things. That the disconnect from the humanity of that really speaks to the privilege of and the power of white privilege in this country. And this is where we could tie this very nicely into the Amy Cooper incident in New York City.
I was just scribbling her name. Yes, go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
Exactly what to say to weaponize the police against this black man. And it wasn't that she's not politically conscious, because she referred to him as an African-American gentleman.
Yes, she did.
So she knows the right speak and the right language.
That's right.
And it just so happened, and she's calling the police with a blatant lie that everyone's looking at and telling him, I'm going to call the police on you, because she knows that what happens when the police arrive is that her white privilege takes a step forward and his blackness takes five steps backwards. And the police are going to more than likely respond to her in acts of violence against him. So she wanted to use the police as her personal security force to weaponize against this African-American man. That's what white privilege really looks like. And it's much greater than that, but that's just a great telling example.
And just to complete that story, she did lose her job.
And the dog.
And the dog
and
on top
the
of
dog
that.
Back.
And he, Christian Cooper, the man who was bird watching in Central Park, was very sympathetic to her, her plight, which I was kind of extraordinary. I think it's a moment that sort of encapsulates so many things that perhaps has been overshadowed. But anything, Tracy Kesey, you want to add to that?
Yeah, so I think so. Absolutely. So you mentioned that, you know, Mr. Cooper was, you know, empathetic. Therein lies the double burden of black
folks.
Exactly. Right. So as if he does not have the permission to be angry and not to accept any apologies that come along, there's an expectation that once again that you should swallow and be good. And so I think what we really, I mean, there's so many conversations, and this is so deep on so many different levels. But again, you're watching another expectation of black folks, right? Empathy, which, you know, we always seem to have forgiveness, which we seem to use abundance of. And the question is again, at what cost and for how long, you know, and if you ever heard him talk about that incident, you know, he was conflicted, you know, I didn't necessarily want her to lose her job. And so, you know, and folks, you know, I know I'm looking, I'm like, okay. But this is what we go through. This is the double bind we go through. And so it's a struggle. It is a struggle.
Well, we are almost out of time. And gosh, I wish I could stop time so we could continue to talk. But Donald Tibbs, let me just give you the final word. We have about a minute or so before we have to say goodbye. And as you mentioned, you know, you and I have talked about police brutality and some of these racial incidents untold numbers of times, too many times, frankly. Do you think this is a turning point, or is that just too much of a kind of fuzzy question to ask?
I want to believe it's a turning point. And what I see here that I think is different, maybe perhaps in prior protests and prior incidents, is that it's really hard to find anything that George Floyd really did to deserve this. Not that other killings of unarmed black men were deserving in any aspect, but this one is so, the images are so powerful and the outrage is so massive. You know, we're only talking about outrage across the United States. We should tune in to the way people are protesting around the world. I mean, there's murals of George Floyd going up in other countries. Everyone is connected to racism and the way that the underclass are treated all around the world. And so this is an opportunity for us. That I said before with Michael Brown, that I said before with Trayvon Martin, that I said before with Laquan McDonald, Tamir Rice, Alton Sterling. This is an opportunity that if we seek it and we grasp it and we take advantage of it, we can make some change. I just want to
Well,
say
you know what? You
thing.
Can't. I'm so sorry.
Okay.
You can't.
Right.
They're playing my song. We got to end the discussion. We'll have to have you two back again. Donald Tibbs, thank you so much for joining us. And Tracy Kesey, thank you for joining us as well. We do
Absolutely.
Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And we appreciate you joining us on Radio Times as well. Boy, sometimes I hate the clock. What can I say? Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen are the producers of Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us. And Diana Martinez, our engineer today for the show.